We have come now to our study on the Canaanites. Here the word is in terms of the identity of the people. Normally we think of the Canaanites as being a word summing up all the peoples of the land. Sometimes it's used in that very broad sense, but we'll see a little bit more details about that, about a specific group within the land of Canaan, looking at their history and the geography and various cities of the Canaanites, their culture and religion. Let's put it in the bigger perspective, first of all, in terms of the descendants of Noah's sons. We know that we have the Japhethites, like me, that come from Noah's son Japheth and migrated to the north, and those with whiter skin actually are the result of people that are farther north. Seriously, that is what has actually happened to the, in terms of the genetics of the inbreeding and the pigment of the skin. And those who are descendants of Canaan, broadly speaking, or Ham, Noah's son Ham, and his son Canaan, ended up with darker skin. They migrated farther south, and they comprised the land of Canaan and North Africa, as well as the island of Crete. And the third group, then, would be the descendants of Shem, that I'm highlighting here in red. And these three groups come from Noah's three sons and comprise the table of nations that are noted in Genesis chapter 10. So looking at it again, Japheth, Ham, and Shem are depicted in this map in different ways. Japheth with regular letters, Ham all capitals, and Shem italic capitals. The Caucasian people come from Japheth and through migration, the East Indians are basically the same bone structure as the Europeans, but they migrated farther south and their skin ended up darker as a result. The descendants of Ham, broadly speaking, have been called the Canaanites. Africans and Asians resulted from them. I say Asians because there was a city called Sin in north of Israel that was a starting place for the people who migrated from there to the south to the Sinai or the Sinai Peninsula. This is how we get the name of the Sinai Peninsula. But another group from Sin migrated eastward and have become our Asians, our East Asians. And so we talk about Sino-American relations, for example. That would refer to especially Chinese relationships with the U.S. And these Sino people mean that the Canaanites, part of them, resulted in Asians as well as Africans. The third group of people were the Shem descendants. They're not called Shemites, they're called Semites. And this would be the line of blessing from Abraham that comprised the Jews and the Arabs, some other people also from Shem, but I'm just speaking broadly here at this point. So in relationship to the Canaanites, linguistically, we actually have two classifications of their language. The Western Canaanites that had both the northern and southern peoples, the Levant, the northern one, which would comprise Syria and Israel especially, and then the southern ones, Arabia and Ethiopia, south of Egypt. But there are also eastern Canaanites, some who stayed in the Akkad that founded the language of the Akkadians, that was the language of Assyria and the Babylonians. And then we also have others of the Tigris and the Euphrates River Valley. So not all the Canaanites went over to the land of Canaan. If we're looking broadly speaking, and we're not thinking of the flood being in its normal place of 2187, we would see the Canaanites as coming from this land even 900 years earlier than that, in 1300 or 3300. And in their history, the first towns were built during this period, not really large, population seldom exceeded 2,000 people, but they developed urban societies, for example, in the city of Arad. And there was a lot of interference from Egypt, because Egypt wanted to come on up into Canaanite territory, especially the 13th dynasty around the year 2000, the time of Abraham. The Egyptians wanted that main trunk road, the Via Maris, or the Great Trunk Road, that went along the coast of the land of Israel, because that was the main trade route that linked Africa, Europe, and Asia. When we get to the Middle Bronze period, we see Hyksos, who were actually Canaanites, who ruled over northern Egypt for about 100 years. Some have identified those people with the people of Israel, but I don't think so. They were actually Canaanite people that migrated, and they had a strong showing there in Egypt. But Pharaoh Ahmosis drove out the Hyksos and then destroyed the Canaanite cities around that time. This says 1539. This would be looking at more like and then they ended up rebuilding after that. This still fits into an early date for the Exodus. And then we have the Late Bronze period of Egyptian domination over the land of Canaan. There was a huge battle at Megiddo where Canaan was conquered and ended up paying heavy tribute and taxes to the Egyptians. So this is a very important land, and it was fought over during the early times. It was later fought over by another couple groups of Greek rulers around 300 to 167 BC as well, because this was your main trade route. When we get into the Iron Age, Canaan saw the arrival of the sea people that migrated from Crete or the Aegean area, such as the Philistines. And these people occupied the northern and the coastal regions and led to the collapse of the Canaan city-states. As we know, the Philistines were very, very fierce people, and we'll have another session on Philistines later. But settlements were established, and then the Phoenician culture developed during this time, particularly strong during Iron One, as the Phoenicians were in the north of Canaan, and they were the great seafarers of the ancient days, but they would be actually north of the people of Canaan. In the Iron II age, these were best known as new states, and this is the time period of Solomon, where we see Solomon moving into this flat area of Israel, gaining strength, and for one of the few, if the only time that Israel ever had iron chariots under Solomon, and chariot cities, and so they are able to get a hold of this area a whole lot more. Large-scale building projects like this water tunnel here there during that time. So when we're talking about Canaan in terms of geography, the scope of Canaan by the Egyptians really pretty much covered the entire land that we would think of as Canaan, with exception of Phoenicia up there in the north. It was the whole area from the Brook of Egypt, that south of Gaza, that covered Ammon, Moab, and Edom, or did not cover them because they were on the other side. In that sense, it wasn't as large as Israel at its larger points. But northward and southward, this is quite a large area that was conquered by the Egyptians. This was dating this from the standpoint of a late date for the Exodus, though. I would think that this actually happened earlier, not all the way to 1200. So I don't think that's consistent with what we find in chronologies. We see in the chronology section. Jericho, of course, was one of those major cities of the Canaanites. It was the first main city that anyone coming across from the east would have to face, that was right there at the Dead Sea area, crossing the Jordan. It was a major ford of the Jordan that accommodated travel from the Transjordan through the river to the west. And so Jericho ended up becoming quite a significant city. The Hebrew name derives from the Hebrew word yarad, meaning moon or month or new moon. And other cities, we can say much about that as well in terms of historical and biblical importance. Jericho was the first city to conquer at the Battle of Jericho. And significance of this, of course, was that not that it was conquered through any military means, but Israel's faith in the power of God is prominent here. And we also see the salvation of Rahab. So we see salvations of Gentiles, Rahab and her family, through faith. So Jericho plays a very important part in Israel in that particular way. Going farther north in the central area of the land, we see Gibeon, situated halfway between Israel and Bethel. And this was a fortress city and one of the most ancient Canaanite cities, also known as one of the four Hivite cities in the Bible. And Gibeon, if you remember, was the place where they deceived the Israelites, saying that they had come from a long journey, disguising themselves and tricking Israel. And Israel, as a result, had to protect them. And when Gibeon was attacked by five other Amorite kings, we see Israel actually, God, redeeming this situation where the sun stood still and God enabled the people to conquer the whole southern part of Canaan as a result from Gibeon farther south. And of course, they needed to learn the lesson of consulting the Lord and not being deceived and making, but they also had to keep their word and keep treaties that they had made. And I see in this the faithfulness of God despite our weakness. It's quite a story. What kind of alphabet did we have in Canaan? Well, the single most important and enduring contribution to later civilizations was their writing, because the writing enabled the spread of literacy to the masses rather than just keeping it in the hands of educated scribes. In other words, we have a Phoenician alphabet that actually originated from a proto-Canaanite alphabet of the 18th, 17th centuries. So the Phoenicians ended up taking this Canaanite alphabet and perfecting it. And it looks very much like what we find in Hebrew. We've got 1, 2, 8 across. Yeah, we've got about the same number of letters in Hebrew, which has 22. And these are actually looking quite similar to Hebrew at that time. In terms of their religion, the archaeological discoveries of Baal and El, or Baal and El, show that Baal was the principal deity of the Canaanites. The word Baal, or Baal, means Lord, or master. And he certainly was the master over them, because the Canaanites depended upon Baal for survival. We see, for example, in the Baal cycle, a pretty sad situation. They believe the god of death, Mot, which is the Hebrew word for death, Mot, kills Baal every winter, and it's the responsibility of the people to resurrect Baal. Baal rises and has to have a sexual union with Ashtoreth in order to have the land produce its rain, its spring rains, so they'll have the summer and the fall harvest. And then sure enough, Baal dies again at the hand of Mot the next season. And Baal rises, and the cycle has to repeat itself with more immorality going on among these gods. And so as a result, the religion of the Baal fertility cycle ended up affecting the people in the most horrendous ways. Because with Baal being the one who kills, or Mot kills Baal, and then Baal has to come back to life in the spring, well, this resulted in some pretty pretty sad realities, that being most of all temple prostitution and sexual fertility rites and religious worship to help Baal resurrect in spring. They needed to help him resurrect. And so we see long lines there at the temple trying to help out Baal. It was a convenient religion for men to justify their lust, and not so convenient for women who served as temple prostitutes. Such a sad, sad reality. And all done because they felt that their livelihood depended on it. Does that sound a little familiar? They even took babies. And sad to say, these babies were sacrificed to Baal. Precious newborns. During live worship, the babies were placed on the burning hands, hot hands of the statue of Baal, with loud music and drums and anything as loud as it could to drown out the screams of these babies being burned alive. And then after dying, they were pushed into a hole underneath. All that because they felt that without killing their children, they would not be able to maintain their economic lifestyle. Does that sound a little familiar in terms of modern child sacrifice? Untold millions, hundreds of millions of babies have been murdered in their own mother's womb, even before they have a chance to breathe, like they did. At least they had a chance to breathe under Baal worship. In fact, Walter Elwell says, I'm quoting here, contact among the religions of the ancient Near East produced not only tension, but also much syncretism, or borrowing of concepts and practices. When Canaanite polytheism is compared with that of Mesopotamia, striking similarities appear that probably wouldn't have occurred had the societies been totally isolated from each other. For example, some scholars suggest that in both cultures, authority resided with the sky god. That was the only concept of authority. That was the only concept of authority, however. The implementation of authority needed some other deity. I think this meant that was not the only concept of authority. The implementation of authority needed some other deity. And although the sky god of Mesopotamia was Anu, the real power was exercised by Enlil, god of wind and storm. Likewise, El was the nominal head of the Canaanite gods, but the chief functions of deity were exemplified by the personification of storm, the god Hadad. He was the Baal, or lord of gods and of humankind. So we see the Arameans and the Philistines who settled in Canaan adopted the practices of the Canaanites. Similarly, the Amorites accepted much of the Sumerian religion as their own when they moved into Mesopotamia. Among all those peoples, however, the Hebrews took an independent course. Their god was the unique and cosmic deity who demanded exclusive allegiance. And such a concept ran against the grain of all the religions of the day. So in other words, there was a lot of trade and bartering of religious ideas among these others. And yet God told Israel not to be involved in that. They had a unique relationship with their own God. And for much of Israel's history, they did do that. But sadly, they ended up becoming influenced by the Canaanites. And in terms of religion, this definitely was the worst of the religions. Merrill Unger says in Archaeology in the Old Testament, the brutality, lust, and abandon of Canaanite mythology is far worse than elsewhere in the Near East at that time. And the astonishing characteristic of Canaanite deities, that they had no moral character whatever, must have brought out the worst traits in their devotees and entailed many of the most demoralizing practices of the time, such as sacred prostitution, child sacrifice, and snake worship. No wonder why God told the people to go in the land and make no treaty with them. He knew that they would adversely impact the people of Israel. And sadly, their influence on Israel was one of syncretism. Yahweh was the God of power, while Baal was the God of everyday life. And Baal worship ended up making its way into Israel and had a huge impact, especially in the northern nation. Not until after the return from exile in Babylon was monotheism maintained by the Israelites. They also became a polytheistic people. And why was Israel so influenced by them? Well, as we saw, there was a similar dialect. The language wasn't that different. They also enlisted Canaanite help for superior weapons. As we see the Israelites going down to Philistine territory to sharpen their weapons and their plows, so they enlisted the same from the Canaanites. It's so easy for us to be drawn to those with the technology that is superior to ours, and then as a result end up adopting pagan ideas with more advanced technology. Does that sound familiar? And superficial resemblance to the Hebrew religion in terms of peace offerings and divine titles. I mean, their gods were called El, and we have the title in Israel, El Shaddai, that sort of thing. There was borrowing like that. Yeah, but the resemblance was only superficial. And there was this appeal of syncretism to have the best of both worlds, with both Yahweh and Baal. Wow, and the same thing can happen today. Does it not? We think we can have the best of both worlds, and yet we end up getting sucked into false worship. So how did Israel fight against the Canaanite influence? Well, the way to do it was good theology. They really need to know what their book said that taught one God. They needed to know the Genesis polemic. In other words, the defense from Genesis 1. To realize that their God was the high God, and there really were no other gods that were involved in creation, and to know the character of God, their God, especially the fact that God was holy, as seen in his divine presence in the Ark of the Covenant dwelling among them. And this is why the prophets taught against the religious practices of Canaan. They said, you know, there's a similarity in appearance here, but the differences in morality are striking. So sad to see this picture of a Canaanite grabbing his baby by the leg in order to offer him as a sacrifice to Baal. Not only human sacrifice, but temple prostitutes. We can see why God did not allow any women to serve as priestesses at the temple. It was to protect the women. Child sacrifice. And human sacrifice, adults and children, mutilation, even bestiality. And in terms of religion, here actually was Israel's most successful counterattack. By emphasizing the personal nature of God, we see poetic imagery celebrating God's sovereignty in a language that actually the Canaanites would be able to understand. So what would be some lessons for us? Well, in respect to child sacrifice, you know, God hates it so much that it was the precipitating factor for judgment on Israel. Do we practice child sacrifice today? Honestly, why are abortions performed today? Why? Is it not because we have the same concerns, that we don't believe that God can supply our needs with another mouth to feed? And children are seen as a liability rather than as an asset. Syncretism also can happen today. Do we worship other gods like career and then fall back on God only when we're in trouble? That's called syncretism. That's a little bit of Jesus and a little bit of the world and a little bit of this and that and mix it all together. Basically, it's a create your own religion. In terms of evangelism, how do we use today's culture and language to present God to this generation? How do we do it? You know, we speak the same language. In fact, the fact that you're here, the fact that you're listening to me talk right now means that you know English. You have a phenomenal opportunity to have an impact on the world through the English language. And I find that on this website, I have hits from all over the world, every continent, because English is the language spoken throughout the world. And yet we need to be careful to make sure that we don't buy into the world, even in the many heresies that are taught in English as well. So I hope you can take a little time for a small group discussion. And once we turn this off, you can think through and talk through these questions with the people around you. Number one, how do you preserve godly values amidst your Canaanite age? How do you, in particular, do it so that you can not be influenced by the Canaanite society that's around us today, Canaanite-like society, Canaanite values? How do you actually preserve godly values in that context? What do you think is the most effective means you have found to be in the world, but not of the world, as Jesus said in John 17:15? I'm not asking you to take them out of the world, but to keep them safe from the evil one. As you discuss these things, may the Lord lead you into ways where you can be like God says, rather than being like the Canaanites.